speaker for this afternoon is Larry Johnson. Larry is the executive director of the Association of Black Cardiologists. He's also commissioner and chair of the DeKalb County Board.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. I guess everything has been said, and I'm one of those people who grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I turned out all right. I was in the Inglewood area, so it was bad back then, so George and him is working to make it even better now. Still bad.
But there is a vitality.
It's a vitality, okay. Y'all work on that for me. I want to talk about the capacity building efforts of the Association of Black Cardiologists and talk about what Dr. Troutman talked about, Dr. Martin talked about as well. I want to thank Dr. Troutman. I went to work for Dr. Troutman back in 2001 to run a Reach for Wellness project, which is Reach 2010 back at the time. So I really appreciate the opportunity. This is where I learned a lot of my health disparities work. Had a chance to lead the effort to make sure Fulton County was one of the number one programs in the state. And so I really appreciate that as well. But now, next slide, please. Association of Black Cardiologists was founded in 1974. We have over 2,500 members. And what's significant about that, most people think that only cardiologists can be a part of us. No, you don't have to be. I'm not a cardiologist. I'm in public health. But we have lay members. We have members all over our communities, nurses, anybody who can join our organization. And the answer is free for folks like you all in this room. Just go to abc.org. But our mission is very simple. It's to champion the elimination of cardiovascular disparities through education, research, and advocacy. Here's some of our programs that we offer. We're an accredited organization. We work with other health professionals. We do national conferences. We have a lot of events. We have one next week in Chicago called the Booker Symposium. It's free at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. And it's focusing a lot on health disparities and really trying to bring our medical model and our public health together as we try to tackle this issue. Research is key. We have a lot of, we try to encourage our members as well as our community to get involved in clinical trials, which are very important for us to stamp out a lot of diseases that we face in our community. Advocacy is the piece that I focus on a lot. That's the Vice President for Community Affairs. I just started with them in February, but those are some of the things that we are focusing on as a community. Next slide, please. This is one of the programs that I'm proud about that we started in 2009 that I've picked up on and kept it going. We do a Spirit of Heart campaign. This is a leadership forum. We just had one in Atlanta last week, and we had our regional director from HHS, Anton Gunn, which was just appointed by President Obama in September. 38-year-old young man, master's in social work. He's a former state representative from the state of South Carolina. And so he's over about seven states, Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia. He was part of our forum, as well as we provide a state representative, county commissioner, a board of health member, and a layperson from the community to talk about what is our call to action in this community, and it could be any community. The second day is a health expo. We go to one of our large churches in Atlanta, and the church we picked this time was Greater Travelers Rest, which has over 8,000 members. They have two services. They're doing a great job. The pastor is trying to engage the community. He just got there about 2 years ago, about 36 years old, but he is now taking that whole community over in terms of being holistic in his approach to the community. We provide screenings free of charge. We do workshops. We have cardiologists come out and actually sit at the table and help people as they go through their regimen and learn about what's going on. We have physical aerobics instruction. We have workshops all day. The last day is a Sunday worship service, and we have one of our cardiologists have a message from the pulpit. And if you see, we just passed out to you our seven steps to a healthy heart. And you'll see on the back, the first step is to be spiritually active. It was a study done at Duke University. We said if you're spiritually active, you live 14 years longer. And so that's something to take in mind as you move through life. Take charge of your blood pressure, control your cholesterol, track your blood sugar, eat smart, enjoy regular exercise, don't smoke, and access better health care. And this is the bookmark that we give every citizen or anybody that's in our program so they can remember and make sure they take charge of their health and their community. Here's our impact of our program so far. We've hit about six states. We just finished, like I said, in Georgia. We've been to Philadelphia, Chicago. We've been to Jackson. And we've also been to, what's our last state? I forget. Next slide. But this is one of the dynamic programs that we have. And we teamed up with the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. It's called the Community Health Advocacy Training Program. Last year, we trained over 150 advocates where we flew them to Washington, D.C., and we had a two-day training with them around coalition building, policy making, how they can go back into their communities and really take charge of what they're doing already. And the amazing thing about the CHAD program is that these are lay people who are already leaders in their community. So we're not teaching them nothing new. We're just adding on to what they're doing already to make their communities better, and that's what George talked about earlier. We're not just trying to bring anything new in. A lot of these communities already have leaders in place and are making the difference in our community. We're just trying to be part of their success story and build on that as well. These are the programs we've done already in Memphis. We have one that we're going to do in Charlotte. We have a young cardiologist from Harvard who just started a free clinic in Charlotte. He's very dynamic. He's also started an incentive program for residents in that community. We're going to go back there to help him in terms of build leaders or health advocates who can help him in his work as he go forward in Charlotte, North Carolina. Next slide, please. This is the other hat that I wear. I'm a county commissioner in the second largest county in Georgia. It's probably hard to see, but I'll try to read it as much as I can. We've created what I call a wellness zone. It didn't happen on purpose. It just happened as we started to move public policy in my community. And what happened was the community in 2005 wanted to do a bond initiative. And in that bond initiative, they said we want libraries, we want recreation centers, and we also want to make sure we have sidewalks for people in our community. When I first got elected, it was crazy. And I talked about sidewalks in our community, and they said, we don't want to pay for sidewalks. Why are you using our tax dollars to do sidewalks? And it was amazing. Dr. Troutman was the head of the department at the time, and I just got elected in 02. You had people literally calling after that wanting me to get fired because they didn't want me to use our taxpayer dollars to get sidewalks. But we prevailed. It passed by a 4-3 vote, and that was the first initial thing. About $17 million of sidewalk money had went into the budget that was used, and that was in 2003. And from every point on, we put together probably about from 17 million to right now, about 8 times 17 million. So you can figure about $90 million into making sure we have walkable green space in our communities. Part of that endeavor is I built an $18 million performing arts and community center on 20 acres of land. And this art center is used to do from pottery to acting to, we even got stepping classes. This is from Chicago. We got stepping classes over there now. And we had we do stepping classes over there.
May I ask you to demonstrate?
That's right. We can do one.
Some people know what you're talking.
And we did something in March where we had stepping classes, and we also had something around saving black marriages. So we had a saving black marriages workshop. And we had over 500 people attend, and also had stepping as part of that whole workshop and everything. It was an amazing feat. But around the corner, in April of next year, I'm building the first intergenerational center in the southeast. It's a $10 million facility. It's going to be for our seniors and young people to come. We're going to have from aerobics to basketball to volleyball to just pottery, and the weights are going to be built so everybody can enjoy at the same time. Early learning education will be part of that whole curriculum in that place. And we also have a Wonderland Garden where every citizen can get their own plot of land and do their own garden. And it's all within, right around the corner from each other. So it's a 165-acre park. But all of these facilities are right there. And we've also added on to that with Kappa Alpha Psi and Delta Sigma Theta. We've given them a building, and I've given them $50,000 to do an achievement center right in the community, focus on home buying, literacy classes, all these things that are needed in our community to make a difference. So that's a $30 million investment that I've made in terms of just trying to make sure we have public policy as part of the equation. And then we talk about African-American professionals, and I talked about it from our ABC standpoint of having a master's in public health where you can work in a nonprofit to do it, but also how you can do it from a public policy elected standpoint where you don't just have, I don't have to wait for a committee to get it done on the elected side. I could just say, we need to do this, let's move and do it, and it can happen in our government. But also the people now rallied around this because now everybody wants sidewalks. Everybody wanted to have a nice park, and every park that now is created, you have to have a walking trail around the park. So we have parks with walking trails and benches. You can fish in the parks. So those things are happening, and now you see seniors as well as young people now fishing in the parks. And these were areas that people didn't want to go in, but now they're using it more and more as we speak today. So those are some of the things that we're doing, and I think that was my last slide. I'll give you a slide on how to reach me. And so this is my information, and we also have a DC headquarters and also Atlanta headquarters. So we're trying to make sure that the Association of Black Cardiologists is impacting not only locally, but also the nation. And so we want to make sure we have that. Our slogan is saving the hearts of a diverse America. And so we want to make sure that that's happening all the time. So thank you.
Before we started, we told people there would be index cards in the back, so if people have questions, they could put them on an index card. I told all the panelists that I would address a question to each of them to get us started. So I'll ask each of the panelists one question, and then we'll open up the floor to questions. My first question is to Dr. Stephen Martin, who was our first panelist. What do you see as the parallels between the Great Migration and this change of African Americans leaving urban centers and moving to the suburbs?
Yeah,
I know they weren't expecting these questions.
I wasn't expecting that. The great parallels.
Are there parallels? I mean, do you see any parallels?
Nah, let me think of that. That's a good one.
That's
a good question. At the moment, I cannot.
Okay.
Like, I can't come.
Okay.
Come back.
I'll come back to you. Yeah. And I'll go to Adewale. He was the second presenter.
Yeah. Yep.
So I don't know. Maybe I stump everybody. And I was going to ask Adewale a question, but unfortunately, most of the questions I was going to ask can be addressed during the course of his presentation, so it made it pretty easy. Steve did not. And George did not. George's not expecting his question. I know George's not expecting his question. So I told them all to be ready for the unexpected.
Maybe the top member respond to that question since it's all the issues regarding migration.
Did somebody else on the panel want to respond to that?
Well, I mean, you're speaking about the classic migration from south to north,
right?
And the migration
from the urban core to the suburbs.
I think you could say they're parallels. Some of the same issues are going to be attended to moving into new communities in terms of infrastructure and access to, whether it's health or supermarkets or what's the nature of the new community you're moving into, is the migration those who are of means, middle income and higher, or those who can afford to purchase things they need to purchase, or just is it sometimes there's a migration where poor people are pushed out into the suburbs intentionally, to kind of fix the tax base, if you will, and that's certainly not the kind of migration you'd hope for. I don't know Chicago well enough to say. I'm from the South Bronx, not from South Side Chicago.
I'm going to go back and I'm going to ask Steve a different kind of question. It sort of parallels that and picks up on that. The map that George showed of the city of Chicago and the South Side of Chicago when you look at that, what relationship does that have in terms of what you're seeing in suburban Cook County relative to the southwest side of the city and the west side of the city?
What I guess the most unfortunate thing to say about those pictures is that I'm actually getting a first look at what's coming to suburban Cook County. And I don't say that with great happiness, because I can see the concentration of health issues that are in suburban, in the south side of Chicago, are moving. But the difference, as I was highlighting in the presentation, was that within there is a level of capacity within the south side of Chicago. But as those folks are moving into the southern suburbs of Cook County, there is no capacity to address even some of those issues. So I think that is kind of the pretext. And in terms of moving to the west, what's interesting is that what is a little bit different is that the county's health system, a lot of their facilities are concentrated on the west side of Chicago. However, the west side of Chicago is at least within a 1 mile radius of the Strozier Hospital, the county hospital. That is really changing quickly into becoming more Latina in terms of who's living around that area, because those folks have been pushed, African Americans have been pushed out that area and even further west and then further into western parts of suburban Cook County. So it's kind of like looking at what is coming next, and I think that that is the struggle in which our municipalities are having, that we don't have that tax base for that incoming problem, and nor are we ready to really deal with that issue.
Yeah, and to put it, how many people here have been to Chicago? Probably not moved into the communities of Chicago, but being from Chicago, one of the things that's interesting, I use the west side, between the community of Austin and the city of Chicago and Oak Park, there's a common street. And it depends upon which side of the street you live on as to whether you live in the city of Chicago and whether you live in Oak Park, which is a suburban community. And I can tell you that the people that live on the west side of Oak Park, of Austin Avenue, are not like, they don't live in the same, they don't have the same lifestyle, same quality of life as you go further into Oak Park. And it's similar, and I think that's what we're seeing. It's similar to the people that live in the community of Austin. And the same is for the south suburbs. Usually what you see, and you wouldn't even know if you left the city of Chicago, where the border is between the city of Chicago and the suburb, because it's usually a common street. And it really depends upon what side of the street you live on as to whether or not you live in the city or you live in the suburbs. Adewale, another question for you. And this I wanted to ask very directly. And you talked about framing research.
Yes.
And implied in that, but you didn't get into it, because you talked about, and George talked about it too, assets, but you didn't talk about any community asset mapping is that some of what you were talking about? Is that something you look at when you look at framing your research?
No, in that particular conversation, I was focusing primarily on language. The importance about asset mapping is that many of us automatically go to the deficit signs and start looking at gaps, what's not here, what's wrong, and you lose the communities of a positive spirit because you haven't done the asset mapping. So I mean, you need to do both. But I think it's always great to start with the asset mapping at the community level, because people get a sense of, you know, what's over here, and they can feel better about what the resources are available before you start talking about gap analysis. Unfortunately, in public health, we get trained that way. Do a gap analysis, go to find out what the problems are, you know, and you automatically put people in a defensive posture by starting with the negatives. So always start with the asset mapping.
Okay, here's your question, George, and you're the one that prompted it. I wasn't here yesterday for the talk that Dr. Cornell West gave, but George told me that he talked about community-based participatory research. Dr. Jenkins did, and he said it was nothing new, and he compared it to Tuskegee. Was that correct?
Yes.
What's the difference between then and now?
That's the question. What's the difference between then and now?
Well, I guess, just my understanding, I think it's really not a difference. It's a way in which those of us who are in the community and from the community have to realize power And I think it's the sharing power. I think that's the difference now, is that we have to make sure, and I mean we, that both sides, whether the academia or the community, realize it's a sharing power. You have to share the power. And we know that research is driven by having a sample size. If your sample size is zero, you have no research. If people don't participate in research, we cannot increase the knowledge base. So it has to do with sharing power. And power could be maybe designing of the study, it could be designing of the sample size, and some of you have to really be honest, sharing the money. Because sometimes if you're going to do a research, say you just want to enter data, it doesn't necessarily have to be a university person. It could be somebody in the community who could do that data. Or if you're going to do some things which you're going out and doing some surveys, you can take people from the community and teach them how to do the surveys. It's sort of a win-win, in which that you're saying that you value the community, you realize they have people who have that skills, but you're also helping people to stay employed. This is the United States, we're a capitalist society. We need money. If people don't spend money, the economy doesn't get any good. So my thing is, let's share the power and share the wealth.
Thank you. One final, this is gonna be a real quick question. This is to Larry Johnson. You talked about the role of a professional organization. What would you say is the role for individual professionals? Because everyone in here is a public health professional. What would you say their role is relative to this issue?
Well, I would say your first role is you gotta be true to yourself in terms of in public health. Our role is always on how we can connect with the community and make sure we are part of every decision making that we have to do. So being an advocate is your first and foremost thing you need to be focusing on in terms of trying to make a difference in our community. And I've been able to do that in a lot of ways and been blessed to be able to just say, okay, how can I bring folks together in terms of just making a difference of professionals in our community? And then making sure what everybody said up here is in terms of research, making sure folks who are a part of the area they're researching are part of the solution. I mean, I made sure, and Dr. Troutman was very clear, is that we were not going to hire a resident from the community that didn't make a livable wage in our community. We were committed to a livable wage. We wanted to bring them in at $375 an hour. Everybody had to make at least 10 or more to be equal to us in that whole process. So as a professional, I would try to make sure that we are having an advocacy role, but also making sure that we understand that the community needs to be first and foremost in all of our decision-making processes.
Okay, thank you. Got a question for Dr. Troutman. There was a bullet indicating you operationalized health equity in your organization. What did that include?
Since Larry got up, I'm going to get up.
We have six questions, so.
Okay,
operation.
Essentially meant taking the theory and turning it into practice. So we can talk about health equity all until we're blue in the face, but if we don't practice it, not only in our interactions with each other within the department, but with our community partners, with our funders, in putting together the programs and services that we deliver, in educating the community around assets, around policy development, et cetera, taking the principles of health equity and turning them into real practice within the context of the organization. Most of you probably work in health departments, or some of you do. You know that the traditional health department is not about health equity. It's about an extension of the medical model. It's reactionary. It's about treating disease. It's about, you know, what the hell is the problem today? And it's not about taking the concepts of health equity and social justice and turning them inside out, turning them into the work that we do on a day-to-day basis for the department. And we do that through, we're using the learning organization theory as a method of doing that, which is all about people being involved in every step of the process of identifying direction, identifying discussion, and being engaged in dialogue.
Okay, and thank you.
Whoever asked the question, I'd be happy to let you see some of the specific work that we're doing around operationalizing health equity.
Okay, this is a question that could be answered by any of the panelists. As the issue of incarceration impacts the health of individuals, families, and community, why is it being left out of the conversation about social determinants of health, particularly when discussing health inequalities? How is this billion-dollar industry going to be dismantled along with its unequal impact if we continue to be silent about it? Why is no one on the panel including it in their discussion? Anybody want to take that?
Cook County operates one of the largest detention centers, metro detention centers in the country. And to answer that question, I don't think that, from my perspective, that we are intentionally leaving that out. I think that just highlights just the number of issues around what we're trying to cover. So it's not that we're trying to leave it out. It's just as important as you could ask the question, why didn't we include at least a senior? How are we going to deal with our seniors? We're not even addressing that issue, and the baby boomers who are coming online, let alone we're still trying to figure out infant mortality. So it's not intentional or unintentional. But I will sit here and say that what is interesting, watching the budget process for public safety in Cook County, is that we have a de facto kind of county board, which is the federal government. This odd relationship. So if we don't meet certain standards in our healthcare society, in our healthcare for our inmates, our detainees, or if we don't meet certain conditions of where they live, the federal judge can say, county, do it. You and I don't have, as a taxpayer, don't have any say in that policy development. We have something to say on the end of paying the taxes. Imagine if I had a consent decree to do public health, when I could just go into my county appropriators, because what the federal judge says to the county board is, if you don't do it, the 17 of you are going to jail. And guess what gets done? So it's kind of two fronts. I'm adding some additional thoughts to that, that in terms of, as we think about that incarceration issue, yeah, we have to take down this big industry. But at the same time, you have this other piece that's playing along with it, that's kind of driving its own, that is stifling off resources from other important governmental pieces that need to be operated. So that's the world in which Cook County kind of lives and struggles with as we try to deal with that issue.
I'll just add to that, we have operate a $1 billion budget. $500 million of that is through what we call a general fund. That's property taxes. The other half is through enterprise fund, sanitation, water, and that money stays over there. But 58% of that budget is public safety related, which is a travesty, because part of it is, like you said, we wanted a consent decree. So the judge said, hey, if you don't get these meals right, you don't get this right, you don't get locked up. So a lot of the money had to go to make sure we fixed that jail, which takes about $14 million just in mental health and physical health care, not counting what the county jail would do. But part of it is we have a drug court that we try to do some things around, and now we have a mental health court. Some of the things we try to do around social determinants of health to make sure the drug court is one of our most successful courts. I mean, we have some successes. I mean, graduation, not letting them, locking them up, putting them in jail for first-time offenses has been a great asset to our county. I wish we could expand it and do more, but the way everything is mandated is that, you know, jails receive more money than me having a diversion program. And so that's the travesty that we face today.
I got three more questions. I'm going to try to get them in real quick. In the focus on policy, systems, and environmental approaches, how do you ensure those efforts don't have unintended consequences on the most vulnerable? Anybody want to take that? In the focus on policy, systems, and environmental approaches, how to ensure those efforts don't have unintended consequences on the most vulnerable?
Let me just, very quickly, there is something called systems thinking. We all know that. Systems thinking on the front end talks about recognizing what the consequences may be, unintended or otherwise. We had a conversation this morning with the feds talking about this new prevention council that the Surgeon General is chairing, and this notion that physicians are now going to be able to do screenings and all some of the things that they're talking about. And my question this morning was, an unintended consequence could very well be the further degradation of local public health, because now things are going to be driven to practitioners and small clinics all over the place, and the work that public health has been doing traditionally, we may lose that, which means we may lose our ability to provide our own. So that's an unintended consequence that nobody really thought about. The capsule answer is systems thinking. Whenever you put a policy or practice in place, you need to think through what the consequences may be, and there may be unintended negative consequences as well. As a matter of fact, Bill mentioned that last night in his discussions about the Tuskegee study, not the Tuskegee experiment to make the difference, but the Tuskegee study. That study was done theoretically with good intention, but it turned out to have very, very, very negative toward consequences in the back end.
Okay. This is for any panelists. What role do you think business can and or should play in addressing health disparities? There are two questions, but I'm only going to ask one of those. Anybody?
I think our business community actually plays a great deal in our policy development. It's interesting that in Cook County, and even portions of Lake County, we have headquarters of McDonald's, we have Kraft, we have Allstate, we have State Farm, we have some of the biggest food purveyors as well within there are driving some of these issues that we're trying to attack. It is interesting to have conversations with them. The food industry, particularly the food industry, wants to engage us, but they're also kind of playing a playbook in the same as the tobacco lessons. And in terms of as we're starting to roll out our issues, they're rolling out the same playbook in terms of no soda tax, no none of these issues. So I think we need to engage them quickly and get them into a conversation about what is it that they foresee that drives, that makes them money, and what issues that we try, what policies we can help in their companies to make folks healthy. They're important.
And I'll just add to that, big business is already in control of a lot of these things. I mean, your sidewalks, your roads, all those are built by big construction companies. The water that you drink, these plants that are built, you can't build much of anything without big businesses in terms of how they do the infrastructure environmentally, as well as what you see is going on around you now, which drives jobs, which you can try to create that corporate citizen by doing it. I mean, our businesses in our community, they have to be set aside at least 20% of the positions for people who live in our county, because we have such a high unemployment rate, which can lead to living wages and jobs in the folks that live in our community. So you can put some type of mandates when you, as government, when you're giving out these contracts to make sure that these folks do business with people who live in your community. And I've also done it with Walmart. I was the first commissioner to have two of the biggest Walmarts inside of the perimeter. And so I made Walmart set up something where if a person had a product that would like to be put into that Walmart, that person can deliver that product and make sure it was carried in that Walmart. And guess what? That created a lot of wealth and created a lot of jobs in our community. So some things that you can do creatively to make that happen.
We've got two more questions, and we may be lucky enough to get them both in. Do you have any advice for young researchers who are interested in global and local health disparities, but who are from privileged backgrounds? As a white American woman, I sometimes worry that my work within vulnerable communities has the potential to reinforce race slash class slash global power inequities, no matter how hard I try to follow and act on the principles of community-based participatory research.
Well, one thing I would say is don't be patronizing. And that's what sometimes it really burns me. And because you're privileged, that's great. You had an opportunity to attain knowledge and expertise. Share it. Share. It has to come with power. Just because on my father's side of the family, my grandfather only got to fourth grade. It was in Mississippi Delta. All of my father's brothers and sisters graduated from high school and also graduated from college. But my grandfather taught me a lot. He only got to fourth grade, but my grandfather taught me a lot. So because you have privilege, you have the responsibility to help others. So my thing is, don't be patronizing. Be informative and willing to show power, because you can learn from them and they can learn from you.
2 cents. The most basic principle of cultural competence is humility. It's not about understanding everybody's individual cultural practices and values. That's good, but it's about humility. It's about how you approach people. If you approach them with openness and support and a loving nature and being humble, then people respond to you. I don't care who you are.
We have one question, one last question that's directed to Dr. Trotman. What are the next steps in creating a social movement you spoke of?
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because we know how to do this. Collectively, historically, we know how to do this. It's about studying what's been done. How many of us know what a social movement is? What are the elements of a social movement? How do you build a social movement? What's the role of the faith community, the students community, professionals? The information is there based upon the history, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, you know, you name the movement, and they've all been based upon the same principles. One of the things that we have to do is recognize that that's where we want to go. And as a group of professionals and community supported folk, make that our ultimate objective. We're not there. And most of the, I would dare say most of the people in our profession don't think in terms of building a social movement. Some of them mistakenly say we need to create a social movement. No, hell no. You know, you don't, as a group of professionals, you don't build a social movement. You support its development. You support the grassroots efforts. You support the analysis. You support the coalition building that leads towards this thing called the social movement. And in fact, I mean, I'm convinced that it can happen, but everybody needs to play their role.
Yeah, I want to thank our panelists. Can I get a round of applause?